Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 256. It's May 6th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Let's get started with a story that accents just how powerful an effect poverty has upon our health. This from Medical Express. Study shows the dramatic impact of extreme poverty on mortality in a racially diverse low-income population. During the past 40 years, the gap between rich and poor Americans has continued to widen in terms of health and mortality, as well as income. Now, in a first-of-its-kind study of an extremely low-income and predominantly black population, researchers at Vanderbilt University Medical Center have found that people who earn less than $15,000 a year died on average more than 10 years earlier than those whose annual income exceeded $50,000. The paper is published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. The paper's corresponding author, Wei Zhang, director of the Vanderbilt Epidemiology Center, noted, "Tobacco smoking is a leading cause of death in the U.S. However, we found that this low-income population excess risk of death due to poverty is greater in magnitude than tobacco smoking." Participants completed questionnaires that collected data about their health and lifestyle and behavioral factors associated with disease, risk, and death, including cigarette smoking, alcohol consumption, physical activity, and the quality of the foods they ate. Individuals in the low-income group, that is less than $15,000 in annual income, who had the worst lifestyle score based on risk factors identified in the questionnaire, had an over six-fold increase in mortality compared to those in the highest income group, those with more than an income of more than $50,000, who had the best lifestyle score. However, low-income participants with the best lifestyle scores had a lower cumulative mortality than those in the higher income group with the worst lifestyle scores, supporting the fact that behavioral and lifestyle factors have on health and lifespan. So that's good news and just accents how there's many very large important factors in health. While powerful as poverty is on impacting our health, lifestyle can also make a large difference and can even obviate many of the differences of income. And of course, you know, you can be very wealthy and have a pretty crummy lifestyle and still suffer a lot of health damage for that. Because low-income communities tend to have a limited availability of healthy food options and less access to health care or to safe, walkable environments that are conducive to regular physical activity, encouraging healthy behaviors and lifestyles cannot fully mitigate the adverse effects of poverty or mortality, the researchers cautioned. Among those in the high-income group, white participants had a lower cumulative mortality risk than black participants. But the situation was reversed in the low-income group. Whites had a higher cumulative mortality than blacks. In the high-income group, the average age of death was 82.7 years for whites and 81.2 years for blacks. In the low-income group, the average age of death was 67.8 years for whites and 70.9 years for blacks. Despite the healthier lifestyle practiced by some groups, the disparity in life expectancy between the two income groups ranged from about 10 years for blacks to nearly 15 years for whites. The researchers concluded, "This estimate is alarming and calls for evaluation of policy and public health strategies to reduce mortality and health disparities in low-income Americans. Without interventions on this specific population to decouple low-income and health, further widening and hardening socioeconomic status gaps might be seen in health. So in this case, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, and that's exacerbating gaps in mortality and morbidity. Okay, well, while income and poverty are large social determinants of health, one that often isn't talked about as much are what we call commercial determinants of health, and this kind of gets at the heart of kind of the corrosive effect of capitalism on a population's health. This from Medical Express. The public's health is heavily influenced by corporations selling tobacco, forever chemicals, fossil fuels, and ultra-processed foods. You go to the gym, eat healthy, and walk as much as possible. You wash your hands and get vaccinated. You control your health. This is a common story we tell ourselves. Unfortunately, it's not quite true. Factors outside our control have huge influence, especially products which can sicken or kill us, made by companies and sold routinely. For instance, you and your family have been exposed for decades to dangerous forever chemicals, some of which are linked to kidney and testicular cancers. You're almost certainly carrying these chemicals, known as PFAS or forever chemicals, in your body right now. And that's just the start. We know exposure to just four classes of products: tobacco, alcohol, ultra-processed foods, and fossil fuels are linked to one out of every three deaths worldwide. That is, they're implicated in 19 of the world's 56 million deaths each year as of 2019. Pollution, largely from fossil fuels, is now the single largest environmental cause of premature death. Communities of color and low-income communities experience disproportionate impacts. Over 90% of population-related deaths occur in low- and middle-income countries. This means the leading risk factor for death and disease worldwide is corporations who make, market, and sell these unhealthy products. Worse, even when these corporations become aware of their harms, the harms of their products, they have often systematically hidden these harms to boost profits at the expense of our health. Major tobacco, oil, food, pharmaceutical, and chemical corporations have all applied similar techniques, privatizing the profits and spreading the harms. When companies act to conceal the harm their products do, they prevent us from protecting ourselves and our children. We now have many well-documented cases of corporate wrongdoing, such as asbestos, fossil fuels, pesticides, herbicides, sugar, silica, and of course, tobacco. In these instances, corporations intentionally manufactured doubt or hid the harms of their products to delay or prevent regulation and maintain profits. Decades of empirical evidence show these effective tactics have actually been shared and strategically passed from one industry or company to the next. For instance, when large tobacco company Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds bought food companies Kraft, General Foods, and Nabisco in the 1980s, tobacco executives brought across marketing strategies, flavoring and colorings to expand product lines, and engineered fatty, sweet and salty, hyper-palatable foods such as cookies, cereals, and frozen foods linked to obesity and diet-related diseases. These foods activate our reward circuits, encourage us to consume. That means buy more. Or consider how forever chemicals became so widespread. A team of scientists, including this article's co-author, investigated previously secret internal industry documents from 3M and DuPont, the largest makers of forever chemicals, PFOA and PFOS. The documents show that 3M and DuPont used tactics from the tobacco industry's playbook, such as suppressing unfavorable research and distorting public debate. Like Big Tobacco, 3M and DuPont had a financial interest in suppressing scientific evidence of the harms of their products, while publicly declaring in-demand products such as Teflon were safe. For decades, forever chemicals PFOA and PFOS have been used to make Teflon pans, Scotchgard, firefighting foam, and other nonstick materials. By the early 2000s, one of these, PFAS, ended up in our blood at 20 times the level its manufacturer, 3M, considered safe. As early as 1961, the chief toxicologist at DuPont's Teflon subsidiary reported the company's wonder material had, quote, the ability to increase the size of the liver and rats at low doses, and recommended the chemicals be handled, quote, with extreme care. According to a 1970 internal memo, the DuPont-funded Haskell Laboratory found the chemical class C8, now known as PFOA and PFOS, as, quote, highly toxic when inhaled and moderately toxic when ingested. Both 3M and DuPont did extensive internal research on the risks of their products posed to humans, but they shared little of it. The risks of PFOA, including pregnancy-induced hypertension, kidney and testicular cancers, and ulcerative colitis, was not publicly established until 2011. Now, 60 years after DuPont first learned the harms of these products, many countries are facing the human and environmental consequences and a very expensive cleanup. Even though the production of PFOA and PFOS is being phased out, forever chemicals are easily stored in the body and can take decades to break down. Worse, PFOA and PFOS are just two of over 15,000 different PFAS chemicals, most of which are still in use. How can we prevent corporate injury to our health? My co-author and I work in the field known as commercial determinants of health, which is to say the damage corporations can do to us. One of the key ways companies have been able to avoid regulation and lawsuits is by hiding the evidence. Internal studies show harm can be easily hidden. External studies can be influenced either by corporate funding, business-friendly scientists, legal action, or lobbying policymakers to avoid regulation. Here are three ways to prevent this from happening again. First, require corporations to adhere to the same standards of data sharing and open science as independent scientists do. If a corporation wants to bring a new product to market, they should have to register and publicly release every study they plan to conduct on its harms so the public can see the results of the study. Two, sever the financial links between industry and researchers or policymakers. Many large corporations will spend money on public studies to try to get favorable outcomes for their own interests. To cut these financial ties means boosting public health research, either through government funding or alternatives, such as a tax on corporate marketing. It would also mean capping corporate political donations and bringing lobbying under control by restricting corporate access and spending to policymakers and increasing transparency. And it would mean stopping the revolving door where government employees or policymakers work for the industry they used to regulate once they leave office. Three, mandate public transparency of corporate funding to researchers and policymakers. In 2010, the United States introduced laws to enforce transparency on how such medical and pharmaceutical companies were spending to influence the products doctors chose to use. Research using the data unearthed by these laws has shown the problem is pervasive. We need this model for other industries so we can clearly see where corporate money is going. Registries should be detailed, permanent, and easy to search. These steps would not be easy, but the status quo means corporations can keep selling dangerous or lethal products for much longer than they should. In doing so, they have become one of the largest influences on our health and will continue to harm generations to come in ways hard to counter with yoga and willpower. And your health is more important than corporate profits. I certainly hope so. And next up, we have a story that highlights the granddaddy of these corporate shenanigans, the tobacco industry. This from Medical Express. As federal menthol ban languishes, black smokers are left to the mercy of marketers. After decades of deception, black adults who smoke menthol cigarettes are often unaware of the deceitful ways tobacco companies market their products to them, according to a Rutgers study. Since the end of World War II, tobacco companies in the United States have pushed menthol products on black communities. Today, an estimated 81% of black cigarette smokers smoke menthols, compared to 34% of whites and 51% of Hispanics. Tobacco companies have enlisted prominent black leaders to lobby against a federal menthol ban, denied the harmfulness of menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars, and used cultural icons to promote their products. Prominent black cultural institutions, such as the National Museum of African American History and Culture, have received funding from companies such as Altria, one of the world's largest producers and marketers of tobacco, cigarettes, and related products. Yet results from the study suggest industry marketing efforts are working. A third, 37%, of respondents said tobacco companies deny the harms of menthol cigarettes. 20% said companies pay black lobbyists to oppose health policies, and 12% said that companies fund black community organizations. While many respondents recognize that tobacco companies target their marketing of menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars to black communities, there was a high uncertainty among black respondents and menthol cigarette smokers about tobacco company activities beyond this marketing. To borrow a saying from my grandmother, tobacco companies are throwing rocks and hiding their hands. As the tobacco industry wages a war of public perception and the federal government refuses to act, it's up to state and local leaders to respond. The high proportion of uncertainty and lack of awareness identified in this study presents a tremendous opportunity for communication efforts to educate the public on tobacco companies' disinformation activities, the researchers wrote. Community-engaged, culturally tailored communication efforts are needed to better educate the public about tobacco industry activities that impact black or African-American communities. And in a similar vein, this from Stat News, state houses are a hotbed of tobacco lobbying and legislation. Around the country, state houses are being flooded with tobacco industry lobbyists, according to a new report from the anti-smoking advocacy group Action on Smoking and Health. There are now at least 950 lobbyists representing cigarette and vape companies in state houses around the country, according to the latest edition of the group's Tobacco Industry Lobbyists and Lobbying Firm Registration Tracker. The number of lobbying registrations tied to tobacco companies jumped over 10% from 2023 to 2024. The overall tally, which is based on public available lobbying registration data, is likely an undercount because several states only require lobbying firms, not individual lobbyists, to register with the state. The three states with the largest number of lobbyists are Pennsylvania, Florida, and good old Ohio, with 76, 60, and 46 respectively. So just Ohio has 46 registered tobacco lobbyists. Yikes. The number of state house lobbyists on tobacco company payrolls is a testament to the amount of smoking and vaping-centric legislation that has moved through state houses over the past 6 months. Much of that activity centers around state lawmakers' attempts to pass bills that would help clear the market of illegal flavored vapes, which are overwhelmingly popular with young people. In Ohio, for example, there is a growing fight in the state house over whether local governments can ban flavored vapes. A bill preventing localities from enacting their own flavor bans has pitted the Republican-controlled state legislature against the state's Republican governor, who has attempted to veto the legislation. In January, the legislature overrode the veto, and last month, several localities in turn sued the state, arguing that localities have the right to pass their own tobacco laws under the state's constitution. So the fight continues with the various merchants of death.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning. Use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
And next up, we have a story that gets at how the health sector is starting to recognize that civic engagement is, in fact, a social determinant of health. This from The Nation's Health. Health sector working to ramp up voting civic engagement. From local city councils to the White House, health will be on the ballot in hundreds of races in November. Armed with innovative tools and groundbreaking new strategies, public health organizations are uniting in historic ways to improve population health, by strengthening civic and voter participation across the health sector. States with more inclusive voting policies and higher civic participation rates have better health outcomes, research consistently shows. A Pew Research Center report found that despite 2020's record voter participation, one-third of U.S. eligible voters did not cast a ballot, and more than half of eligible voters did not cast a vote in 2022, the midterm elections. Work to bring voter registration and civic engagement activities into routine Healthcare is growing, said Aliyah Bhatia, executive director of VOTER, Voter, a nonpartisan organization working at the forefront of integrating the two. VOTER programs have expanded into more than 500 hospitals and clinics and have helped tens of thousands of Americans register and prepare to vote, she said. Whether it's through providing voter registration materials in waiting rooms, alongside discharge paperwork, or healthcare providers asking patients if they are registered to vote, and using VOTER badge backers to register them in the office in real time, health and medical organizations are playing a pivotal role in expanding access to the democratic process. Even Healthy People 2030, the federally led program that sets 10-year health objectives for the nation, has chimed in. Last year, Healthy People's objective to increase the proportion of voting age citizens who vote was recategorized from a research objective to a core objective. Voting offers a chance for people to contribute to decisions that can affect their communities and directly or indirectly impact their health and well-being, the objective says. And I will note, there's a very practical effect of this. Those communities that die early are not allowed to vote because they are dead. So let the living advocate for all of us, and let's extend that length of living, please. Okay, well, next up, we have some good news on the regulatory front. This from the Environmental Health Network. EPA introduces new rules for legacy coal ash pond cleanup. New regulations released by the U.S. EPA aim to tackle the cleanup of legacy coal ash ponds, requiring stringent measures to prevent groundwater contamination. The regulations extend 2015 rules demanding closure of coal ash ponds that contact groundwater. Utilities are mandated to monitor and rectify any leaks and ensure groundwater is cleaned from contaminants. The new rules could face challenges due to varying state regulations and potential political shifts post-election. Quote from the story, EPA's new rule is aimed at cleaning up coal plants once and for all, said Lisa Evans, senior attorney at Earth Justice. Why does this matter? Legacy coal ash ponds and often unlined pits where coal power plants have historically disposed of the ash residue from burning coal poses significant environmental and health risks, particularly to groundwater systems. Over time, these ponds can leak hazardous contaminants like arsenic, mercury, and lead into nearby groundwater, which many communities rely on for drinking, bathing, and irrigation. Coal ash disposal disproportionately impacts poor communities and people of color. Residents in affected areas may face increased risks of cancer, neurological disorders, and other health problems associated with long-term exposures to heavy metals. Okay, well, next up, we have a story on a source of indoor air pollution. This from Medical Express. People with gas and propane stoves breathe more unhealthy nitrogen dioxide, study finds. A study of air pollution in U.S. homes found that households with gas or propane stoves regularly breathe unhealthy levels of nitrogen dioxide. I didn't expect to see pollutant concentrations breach health benchmarks in bedrooms within an hour of gas stove use and stay there for hours after the stove is turned off, said Professor Rob Jackson, senior author of the paper appearing in Science Advances. Pollution from gas and propane stoves isn't just an issue for cooks or people in the kitchen, he said. It's the whole family's problem. Among other negative health effects, breathing high levels of nitrogen dioxide, or NO2, over time can intensify asthma attacks and has been linked to decreased lung development in children and early deaths. Although most exposure to NO2 is caused by cars and trucks burning fossil fuels, the researchers estimate that the mix of pollutants coming from gas and propane stoves overall may be responsible for as many as 200,000 current childhood asthma cases. One quarter of these could be attributed to nitrogen dioxide alone, according to the paper's authors. We found that just how much gas you burn in your stove is by far the biggest factor affecting how much you are exposed. And then after that, do you have an effective range hood and do you use it? Said lead author Yanni Kashtan, a PhD student in Earth System Science. Beyond asthma cases, the long-term exposure to nitrogen dioxide in American households with gas stoves is high enough to cause thousands of deaths each year, possibly as many as 19,000, or 40% of the number of deaths linked annually to secondhand smoke. This estimate is based on the researchers' new measurements and calculations of how much nitrogen dioxide people breathe in at home because of gas stoves, and the best available data on death from long-term exposure to outdoor NO2, which is regulated by the US EPA. The researchers used sensors to measure concentrations of NO2 throughout more than 100 homes of various sizes, layouts, ventilation methods, before, during, and after stove use. This allowed them to estimate nationwide averages and short-term exposures under a range of realistic conditions and behaviors, and cross-check modeled outputs against their home measurements. The results show that nationwide, typical use of a gas and propane stove increases exposure to nitrogen dioxide by an estimated 4 parts per billion, averaged over a year. That's 3/4 of the way to the nitrogen dioxide exposure level that the World Health Organization recognizes as unsafe in outdoor air. That's excluding all outdoor sources combined, so it makes it much more likely you're going to exceed that limit. The study is the latest in a series from this group from Stanford looking at indoor air pollution from gas stoves. Earlier studies documented the rate at which gas stoves emit other pollutants, including the greenhouse gas methane and the carcinogen benzene. Home size matters. Even in larger homes, concentrations of nitrogen dioxide routinely spike to unhealthy levels during and after cooking, even if a range hood was on and venting air outdoors. But people who live in homes smaller than 800 square feet, about the size of a small two-bedroom apartment, are exposed to twice as much nitrogen dioxide over the course of a year compared to the national average, and 4 times more compared to those living in the largest homes, upwards of 3,000 square feet. Because home size makes such a difference, there are also differences in exposure across racial, ethnic, and income groups. Compared to the national average, the researchers found long-term NO2 exposure is 60% higher among American Indian and Alaska Native households and 20% higher among Black and Hispanic or Latino households. The exposure to indoor air pollution from gas stoves compounds the fact that exposure to outdoor sources of nitrogen dioxide pollution, such as vehicle exhaust, is also typically higher among people in poorer, often minority communities. People in poorer communities can't always afford to change their appliances, or perhaps they rent and can't replace appliances because they don't own them. People in smaller homes are also breathing more pollution for the same stove use. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my personal guarantee to you is, if you listen to 1 year of this show, you'll know more about public health than 99% of the people. And if that should turn out to not be the case, I'll gladly offer you triple your money back. Okay, well, next up, got a few stories that are going to get at mental health in America. First up from Medical Express. American adults polled express increasing anxiousness, stress, and sleep, key factors impacting mental health. The 2024 result of the American Psychiatric Association's annual mental health poll showed that U.S. adults are feeling increasingly anxious. In 2024, 43% of adults say they feel more anxious than they did in the previous year. That's up from 37% in 2023 and 32% in 2022. Adults are particularly anxious about current events, 70%, especially the economy, 77%, the 2024 U.S. election, 73%, and gun violence, 69%. When asked about a list of lifestyle factors potentially impacting mental health, adults most commonly say stress, 53%, and sleep, 40%, have the biggest impact on their mental health. Younger adults, age 18 to 34, are more likely than older adults, those over age 50, to say social connection has the biggest impact on their mental health. Despite the increasing anxiety, most adults have not sought professional mental health support. In 2024, just 1 in 4 adults say they talked with a mental health care professional in the last year. Notably, younger adults, those 18 to 34, are more than twice as likely as older adults, those age 50 plus, to have done so. Among adults who have used mental health care this year, more than half prefer to meet with a mental health professional in person, 55%, rather than via telehealth. 30% prefer telehealth, and 15% have no preference. Also among adults who have used mental health care in the last year, more than half, 59%, are worried about losing access to mental health care, and 39% of insured adults are worried about losing their health insurance as a result of the election this year. Americans perceive broad impacts of untreated mental illness. 83% of adults say it negatively impacts families, and 65% it negatively impacts the U.S. economy. Also, 71% of adults feel that children and teens have more mental health problems than they did 10 years ago. That said, more than half of adults, 55%, think there is less mental health stigma than 10 years ago. Other issues people said they were anxious about include keeping themselves or their family safe, 68%, keeping their identity safe, 63%, their health, 60%, paying bills or expenses, 63%, climate change, 57%, the opioid epidemic, 50%, and the impact of emerging technology on day-to-day life, 46%. Plenty of things to be anxious about, apparently. And next up gets at some opinions about the parity between physical and mental health. This is from ABC News. 3 in 4 Americans feel that mental health takes a backseat to physical health. Even though 1 in 5 Americans lives with a mental illness, many feel it is not adequately addressed, with a new survey from West Health and Gallup suggesting that 3 in 4 Americans believe mental health conditions are not identified and treated in the same way as physical health conditions. Roughly 60% of Americans give a poor or failing grade to how mental health conditions are treated, according to the survey. The magnitude of the problem really surprised me, said Tim Lash, president of West Health. He states that the U.S. is not just underperforming, it is failing on a systemic level and in terms of the number of people with unmet needs. The survey shows the impact of mental health challenges is significant, with 51% of people saying they experienced depression, anxiety, or another mental health condition in the past year. Even more concerning, 22% of them said their mental health was so poor it interfered with normal activities, like going to work or taking care of their household. Stigma remains a significant barrier to care, with 7 in 10 Americans believing that society views people with mental health conditions negatively. Mental health challenges often manifest as physical symptoms. Many of the symptoms we encounter in primary care have an underlying psychosocial component, whether it's migraines, back pain, or palpitations. We think a patient may be having a heart attack, and then we end up running all the tests and everything's normal, and then somebody finally attempts to dig a little deeper, potentially revealing a stressful event in the patient's life that triggered their response. Experts say the survey underscores that mental health shouldn't be an afterthought in American healthcare. Mental health professionals say that mental health is as important as physical health. The two are inextricably linked. And in another mental health story, this from CBS News, 12% of LGBTQ youth attempted suicide last year, nationwide survey says. A nationwide survey by the Trevor Project, the nation's leading suicide prevention organization for LGBTQ youth, found that more than 1 in 10 young people in the United States who identify as LGBTQ attempted suicide in 2023. The survey, which focuses on the mental health of LGBTQ young people, included responses from 18,000 people aged 13 to 24, according to a news release announcing the findings. More than a third of LGBTQ young people, or 39%, seriously considered suicide in the past year. That number was even higher for transgender and non-binary youth at 46% seriously considering suicide. Of all LGBTQ youth, 12% attempted suicide in the past year. Despite these risks, half of LGBTQ youth who wanted mental health care could not get it. The suicide risks were strongly associated with anti-LGBTQ victimization, including recent politics and bullying related to their sexual or gender identity. Those who said they experienced bullying reported significantly higher rates of attempting suicide in the past year, the Trevor Project said. And 90% of those surveyed said their well-being was negatively impacted due to recent politics. The survey included information about how to support LGBTQ youth in what the Trevor Project called an attempt to highlight the association between lower odds of suicide risk and access to LGBTQ-affirming spaces and experiences. The survey found that LGBTQ people who reported living in accepting environments attempted suicide at less than half the rate of those who lived in unaccepting communities, and that transgender and non-binary people who had their preferred pronouns used and had access to gender-affirming clothing and school bathrooms had lower rates of attempted suicide compared to those who do not. So, just accenting the fact that discrimination, bullying, and public policy all make a difference. And as a subgroup, LGBTQ youth has some of the highest suicide and attempted suicide rates in the U.S. Okay, next up, let's switch gears and do a healthcare story. This from Stat News. New Medicaid rule expected to lower wait times for home-based care and raise caregivers' wages. Caregivers for older adults and people with disabilities could see a bump in their wages in the coming years thanks to a forthcoming rule by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The new rule brings sweeping changes to a bevy of Medicaid programs throughout the country, including fee-for-service and managed care delivery systems. One of the most notable changes applies to the home and community-based services industry. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services will now require home-based care providers to use 80% of their Medicaid reimbursements they receive toward caregiver compensation. The rule changes were prompted in part by worker shortages that led to long wait times for home-based care, with nearly 700,000 Americans languishing on waiting lists every year since 2016, according to one estimate. The COVID-19 pandemic, skyrocketing home health care costs, and rising wages in other industries hollowed out the direct support workforce, which includes home health aides and personal care aides who help people with daily tasks. Nearly 80% of providers reported that they turn away new referrals in the past year due to ongoing staff shortages, according to a recent report. CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, hopes that this new rule will stabilize the industry and help out caregivers, many of whom are immigrants and people of color. This rule should help ensure that older adults and people with disabilities who need help with activities of daily living can get high-quality support and that they and their caregivers are treated with dignity, said Natalie Keene, Director of Federal Health Advocacy for the nonprofit Justice in Aging. Over 7 million seniors and people with disabilities rely on home and community-based services, according to a fact sheet released last week by the White House. Disability activists have long sought to keep these people in communities rather than in institutions. This new regulation on how Medicaid payments to healthcare providers are structured is part of this broader shift towards home-based care over institutional care. We hope this will increase access to critical home care-based services that let people with disabilities live in their own communities while also improving historical inequities in how this workforce is paid, said Jennifer Love, senior attorney at the National Health Law Program. Providers have up to 6 years to demonstrate compliance with the new rules, and states have the option to offer, quote, hardship exemptions and give small providers a lower threshold than the 80% mandate. So while this is a good move, it's, of course, going to be phased out, basically giving providers 6 years to demonstrate compliance. But hey, you got to start somewhere. A good move for both providers and those recipients of home-based care in Medicaid. Okay, well, switching gears again, you think that having a years-long COVID-19 pandemic would bolster the world in its ability to respond to future pandemics, which is a matter of if, not when, but maybe not. This from The Hill. 4 years after COVID, we are still lacking an international prevention plan. It has been 4 years since the COVID-19 pandemic emerged and caused the deaths and suffering of millions of people across the globe, along with extraordinary economic devastation. In December 2021, the WHO and its 194 member states, all national governments, resolved to draft and negotiate a, quote, convention, agreement, or other international instrument to strengthen pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response. You would think that the governments of the world would seize this unprecedented opportunity to protect themselves, their children, and grandchildren, as well as future generations, from the shattering impacts of pandemics. But you'd be wrong. When the process launched, there was a sense of urgency and commitment to adopt an agreement that would ensure that something like COVID-19 never happens again. But what we have seen in the past 6 months is a decline in political will and a failure to communicate and compromise. Governments, through the WHO, have given themselves until May 10th to reach a consensus on this international instrument, yet appear nowhere close to adopting texts that will truly prevent consequential pathogen spillovers from wildlife that could bring us COVID-25, COVID-26, or beyond. With only 5 negotiating days left on the calendar, governments must show leadership and converge on mutually acceptable texts. Otherwise, we run the risk of a weak agreement or no agreement at all. The WHO suggests that zoonotic spillovers of viral pathogens between wildlife and people have been responsible for up to 75% of new infectious diseases in the past decade. We know how to prevent such outbreaks, and scientists are clear that it's not if, but when the next pandemic will occur, unless strong actions are taken. But most scientists and other non-governmental organization experts are sadly not allowed in the room where the WHO agreement text is being hashed out. While countries must be better prepared and ready to respond to epidemics and pandemics, it is essential that they act now to reduce the emergence of infectious diseases at human-animal-environment interfaces in the first place. The concept known as prevention at source is our first line of defense against future pandemics and acknowledges the interconnectedness between human, wildlife, livestock, and ecosystem health that constitutes the One Health model. Studies show that primary prevention is the most effective and economical way to avoid future pandemics. Yet WHO negotiations have stalled for multiple reasons, including lack of political will and failure to reach a consensus on the sharing of both pathogen information and the economic benefits of vaccines, disregarding critical science on pandemic origins and relegating primary prevention to an afterthought, or no thought at all. Further, the lack of prevention in the agreement would disproportionately harm indigenous peoples and local communities, including particular poor and marginalized communities. The over-exploitation of the environment, forests, and wildlife to meet the demands of urban and global markets increases the contact between people and wildlife and widens the risk of pathogen spillover, which will hit these communities the hardest. Laudable commitments embedded in other multilateral environmental agreements, like the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, and the Convention on the Conservation of Migratory Species of Wild Animals, show progress in One Health and zoonotic spillover prevention in the wake of the COVID crisis, but that is not enough. An inclusive and multilateral agreement is essential to reduce the threats of zoonotic disease outbreaks and address inequities while protecting vital natural resources. A legally binding agreement on pandemics will fail if it does not cover the full spectrum of pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response. To make progress, governments must invite subject matter experts from outside of WHO and civil society to reestablish a science-based discourse that is collaborative and integrated. The negotiators must fully embrace transparency rather than the current closed-door process. After 2.5 years of talking, the global community could deliver an international, legally binding agreement that covers the full spectrum of pandemic preparedness, including a robust and ambitious focus on prevention at source to achieve a global common good for health of health for all. But time is running out. If negotiators fail to act, they place all of humanity at grave risk of a global health catastrophe and the harsh judgment of generations who would look back at this inflection point in horror at the road not taken. Okay, next up, I want to close the regular reporting of this episode with a story that accents and highlights kind of hidden within it the fact that maternal deaths jumped up about 50% during the COVID pandemic because COVID infection during pregnancy is very dangerous. But that's fallen back down. This from Medical Express. Maternal deaths have fallen to pre-pandemic levels, new U.S. data says. U.S. deaths of moms around the time of childbirth have fallen back to pre-pandemic levels. About 680 women died last year during pregnancy or shortly after childbirth, according to provisional CDC data. That's down from 817 deaths in 2022 and 1,205 in 2021, when it was the highest level in more than 50 years. COVID-19 seems to be the main explanation for the improvement, said Donna Hoyert, a CDC maternal mortality researcher. The coronavirus can be particularly dangerous to pregnant women, and in the worst days of the pandemic, burned-out physicians may have added to the risk by ignoring pregnant women's worries, experts say. Fewer death certificates are mentioning COVID-19 as a contributor to maternal deaths. The count was over 400 in 2021, but fewer than 10 last year. The agency last Thursday released a report dealing the final maternal mortality data for 2022. It also recently released provisional data for 2023. Those numbers are expected to change after further analysis. The final 2022 number was 11% higher than the provisional one. Still, 2023 is expected to end up down from 2022. The CDC counts women who die while pregnant during childbirth and up to 42 days after birth from conditions considered related to pregnancy. Excessive bleeding, blood vessel blockages, and infections are the leading causes. There were about 19 maternal deaths for every 100,000 live births in 2023. That's in line with rates seen in 2018 and 2019. But racial disparities remain. The death rate in black moms is more than 2.5 times higher than that of white and Hispanic moms. In the last 5 years, we've really not improved on lowering the maternal death rate in our country. So there's still a lot of work to do, said the March of Dimes Director of Applied Research and Analytics. There are a number of factors that may reduce the ability of women to get medical care before, during, and after birth. Experts say the list includes the closure of rural hospitals and the 2022 U.S. Supreme Court decision that did away with the federally established right to abortion. So we still have many challenges ahead. Okay, well, let's get to bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 31 bonus articles this week. First up, headed towards the finish line, plastics treaty delegates work is far from over, as some see U.S. as obstacle to a robust treaty. And that U.S. Being an obstacle is largely related to the fact that the U.S. is the biggest gas and oil producer in the world, and they don't want to limit production, just the use. So make it and don't use it. Irrational. Bonus article 2. 6 million healthcare workers call for stricter limits on global plastics. Glad to see healthcare workers getting into what is an emerging health issue, plastics. Bonus article 3. Should synthetic bioplastics be allowed in organic compost? Normally, organic compost is very tightly regulated. And as I've reported before, bioplastics are actually, while they come from a, quote, plant source, they're processed in much the same way as other plastics and have a lot of toxic additives. So probably not. Bonus article 4. EPA bans consumer use of toxic chemical methylene chloride known to cause liver and lung cancers. This was most famously used as a paint stripper, but has other uses and will eventually be phased out in most commercial uses as well. Bonus article 5. EPA proposes ban on neurotoxic pesticide acephate, widely used on fruits and vegetables. This, importantly, was after a ProPublica investigation. Way to go, investigative journalists. Bonus article 6. Potential exposure of adults and children to particulates from resuspended nano-enabled consumer sprays. This is actually, as you might recognize, a article from the literature, not from the popular press. But basically what this means is that these new nano-enabled consumer sprays is a new thing, and there are so many new things coming out that have health impacts. This basically means that these sprays might be dangerous in and of themselves, but when you walk around, they actually get resuspended into the air. And particularly for those close to the ground, like little children or playing on the surface, whether it's a carpet or a harder surface, can be exposed to toxins. We should be doing this kind of research before such things come, new products come to market. Bonus article 7, America's growing preference for larger vehicles exacerbates safety risks for pedestrians and increases carbon emissions. Bigger cars is much more dangerous for pedestrians. And of course, bigger cars take more carbon fossil fuels to run. Bonus article 8, better inhalers can help patients and the planet. This is an interesting juxtaposition in that the inhalers that are most typically used produce greenhouse gases equivalent to about 500,000 cars. And the inhalers that are used in other countries that don't use these greenhouse gas compounds actually work better for patients. So it could be a double win. We need to move to that. Bonus article 9, a new form of Mpox that may spread more easily found in Congo's biggest outbreak. So as we know, many of these microorganisms keep evolving. Bonus article 10. WHO overturns dogma on airborne disease spread. The CDC might not act on it. So the dogma here is the way that traditionally we've looked at airborne disease spread is that it's basically particles that have some weight to them. So when you cough, the weight brings them down to the ground. That's why they had 6 feet at the beginning. You know, some people say 3, some people say 10, whatever it is. But the more accurate reality is that these airborne pathogens actually spread all over the place, even hundreds of feet away, once they get airborne. So that's a more accurate way to handle them. Bonus article 11. Too big to care. It's time for a Glass-Steagall Act for healthcare to break up huge conglomerates. So we have it for banks. It should probably do it for healthcare. Bonus article 12. Some 100,000 dreamers expected to sign up for Obamacare under new rule. So this means the healthcare exchange, Obamacare, dreamers will eventually be able to sign up and use that. Good deal. Bonus article 13. U.S. panel and cancer groups differ on new breast cancer screening guidelines. I've reported on this before. There's some nuance to it, and this isn't actually a new thing. There's often differences between different groups. But if you're interested in those breast cancer screening guidelines and what it may mean for you and those you care about, take a look at that one. Bonus article 14. It may be safe to extend time between colonoscopy screenings, large study says. So this basically means if you get a negative result in your first colonoscopy, you can probably wait 15 years rather than the 10 that they recommend. Bonus article 15. What's keeping the U.S. from allowing better sunscreens already available elsewhere? So this is the regulatory framework that's present in different countries. In the U.S., sunscreens are seen more as pharmaceuticals than cosmetics and are regulated differently. But there's actually more effective and safer sunscreens being used in other countries like the EU and Japan. Bonus article 16. A healthy lifestyle can mitigate genetic risk for early death by 62%. This is basically a story that the genes is not destiny, and that lifestyle is a bigger part actually of our health than our genetic destiny, unless you have some really wicked genetic disease. Bonus article 17. Inherited traits can be overstated. Again, there's a big focus on gene therapies and that kind of stuff, and there's a lot of research that studies different genetic DNA strands and what the code is and all that kind of stuff. But the fact is, the way that it's expressed, its interaction with the environment and our behavior is actually even more important. Bonus article 18. Smokers and former smokers may gain lung function from a switch to a plant-based diet. So, a plant-based diet is a good idea. This is just an example that basically it helps with lung function as well. You'd expect that if your body overall is healthier, you might be healthy on pretty much all fronts. And this just shows that even lung function can be improved by a switch to a plant-based diet. Bonus article 19. Global study reveals stark differences between males and females in disease burden causes. So, now, females live longer than males, but females often suffer more morbidity or disability, partly because they live longer and the older age is populated more with these disease burdens. But a good overview of differences in health between men and women. Bonus article 20. Johnson & Johnson to pay $6.5 billion with a B to resolve nearly all talc ovarian cancer lawsuits in the U.S. You don't pay out $6.5 billion unless you've done something wrong. They still won't admit it. Bonus article 21. New research finds resident-to-resident aggression common in assisted living. They found that among 1 in 6 assisted living folks, and previous research has shown 1 in 5 in nursing homes. Bonus article 22, a follow-up on a story I've done before. Potatoes will remain classified as a vegetable, not a grain. Potato, it's all the same. A rose is a rose, although maybe not as delicious as a good potato. Bonus article 23. U.S. intelligence chief warns Congress of rise in cyber attacks, especially in healthcare. So healthcare attacks went up 100% over 1 year. Yikes. Bonus article 24. More states are allowing child support payments to reach children. Some states were actually intercepting those and taking them for the moms being on some kind of income support, welfare support, and it wasn't getting to the children there. Some states are realizing maybe that's not a good way to help children. Bonus article 25. Bird flu is bad for poultry and dairy cows. It's not a dire threat to most of us yet. Good example of that, of 1,000 different threats are probably not a great threat to you any given day, but yet is the key word there. Have to keep an eye on it. It's a good example of public health doing surveillance. A couple more articles on that. Bonus article 26. Texas dairy farm workers case may be first where bird flu virus spread from a mammal to a human, scientists say. So another landmark event. Keep an eye on bonus article 27, tracking bird flu virus changes in cows is stymied by missing data. So this is a transparency issue. You know, the U.S. likes to criticize other countries when there's a potential outbreak and it's hard to get data. But when we have the data, we're kind of reluctant to give out all the details quickly. Bonus article 28, spikes of flu virus in wastewater raise questions about spread of bird flu. So we do check for the influenza A, which includes the bird flu, would show up in that. And if you're testing wastewater, that means if humans are being exposed, you can actually see it, and they can do a specific test. But it's another example of wastewater surveillance can be a good way to track infectious diseases. Bonus article 29. One in four U.S. women will have a clinical abortion in their lifetime. And I say clinical because that only includes those that are supervised clinical abortions. They're not ones that are done at home, for instance. And that number is growing as we're seeing large restrictions across the country. Bonus article 30, partisan gap on abortion larger than ever, survey shows. So about 8 in 10 Democrats support abortion, about 3 in 10 Republicans. You don't see many things where there's a 50-point difference. And that's grown, of course, since the overthrow of Roe. It's a little bit of softening of Republicans, but more so Democrats getting more excited about that. Not having seen that coming, I guess. Bonus article 31. After Roe, the network of people who help others get abortions see themselves as the underground. So there's always been underground movements to protect women's health rights. That was true back in the 60s and 70s, and it is true today. You can view these and other stories by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.